Now I'm speaking with Ian Lawton, who's a filmmaker, and he's putting together funding for a feature-length part animated documentary called The Dharma Bum. The documentary, rather, investigates the travels and travails of Lawrence Carroll, a free-thinking atheist Irish hobo born in the 1850s who upped sticks for Burma and traded booze for Buddhism. Ian, tell me about this man, this interesting man, Lawrence Carroll.
I suppose the easiest way to talk about him is just tell you his story, if that's all right.
That's fine. That's great.
It's a fascinating story, and he was a Dubliner. He was born in the year 1856 in Booterstown, South Dublin, in a tenement building right next door to the local Catholic church. Now, in 1856, Ireland was still a colonialist country. It was ruled by the Brits, and it wasn't a very sort of an accommodating atmosphere to be born an Irish Catholic in that year, and particularly being born right next door to the local Catholic church, which probably influenced his atheism later in life. He was the son of the local greengrocer there, and he had a brother and a sister, both older, I think. And I'd say because of the sort of traumatic upbringing that he had, he Booterstown being very near to Dunleary, a port town, he made his way over to Liverpool, where he started working on the docks, trying to find work at the docks at like age 17, and hit the bottle quite early as well, getting a taste for alcohol. He found it hard to find decent work on the docks until being the son of a local greengrocer, he managed to get work on a ship's pantry, and that ship sort of fortuitously led him on the voyage over to the New World, over to America, and he landed in New York about a year later. Now the Irish again weren't very sort of welcome in New York at that point. It was still the sort of the tail end of the mass exodus of the famine, and he had trouble finding work, etc. So he ended up basically bumming his way across the USA as a hobo, a tramp, jumping trains and living a sort of a beatnik lifestyle, if you like, many years before the beat. He ended up working then on the Sacramento River on the fruit ships there. His sort of knowledge of the shipping routes served him well, and that ship brought him up north to San Francisco. And again, there he ended up working the commerce route between San Francisco and Japan. Living a hard man lifestyle essentially, mm-hmm. because the story goes that on the third trip returning from Japan, he was essentially just kicked off the boat for drunken disorderly conduct. The crew had enough of this, loudmouth, fucking violent Irishman, and left him on Yokohama Beach, basically left for dead. So he wakes up like hungover on that beach the next morning, watching the only connection he had to the West being severed, sailing back to San Francisco. So he's not a word of Japanese or anything like that. He makes his way somehow down through Southeast Asia. He stuck to the coast essentially because his knowledge of working on ships and shipyards. He managed to get jobs as a stevedore, as a beachcomber, tally clerks, things like that. Sticking to the coast where he could have bits of English, but he'd pick up the language along the way. So eventually he made his way all the way to Burma somehow. And it was there where he came across a flyer that described Buddhism to him. And as an atheist, this philosophy really resonated with this man. And I'd say he was probably at the end of his tether, being homeless and hungover constantly. And he went to a local Buddhist monastery to investigate this further. And the Buddhist monks took him in. And it was here that he dried out. He quit the bottle. And then after 5 years studying as a novice, in the year 1900, just at the turn of the century, he became the first white man ever to be fully ordained as a Buddhist monk.
Right.
And that's chapter one. Yeah. I mean, that's only chapter. That's not the end of the story. It's where he went after that that makes this man essentially a legend in my eyes.
Yeah, so that's just the beginning. The beginning really is when he became ordained as a Buddhist monk.
Well, it's a severe transformation from a sort of violent alcoholic hobo to becoming a Buddhist monk in one sense.
Yeah.
But then to what he did as a monk is really what makes this man a legend and a story worth telling in the film I'm making about him.
Yeah, okay.
At that time, it was 1900 in Burma. Burma was in the process of colonization by the British. For about the last 15 years or so, the last five of those, he was, stuck inside a monastery. And then when he saw the light of day at the other end, when he came out as a fully ordained monk, he saw firsthand what the Brits were doing. And essentially what the Brits were doing were sending in missionaries, Christian missionaries, to essentially convert people, the Buddhists, to Christianity in order to be taken over by the British colonies. And so the King James Bible is kind of was designed in a way to sort of brainwash the masses in a sense and made them easily controllable. And they had successfully taken over India at this point with the British Raj, so they had their eyes set on Burma. And Lawrence Carroll, who when ordained became Udamaloka, really took umbrage with this. And essentially what he did was he took out an ad in the local Burmese newspaper claiming himself to be the Bishop of Rangoon and forbidding any Bibles or tracts or any sort of Christian-related information to be distributed to the public. And this was by order of Udamaloka. Which caused a stir in the sort of the British colonies, where who is this guy who's beginning to become a fly in the ointment, as it were.
Okay, Ian, can I just ask a question there? You said that you mentioned there just very briefly now in the last few seconds, or rather that the British were sending in the missionaries to Christianize the Buddhist population.
Yes.
Would Lawrence Carroll have seen this Christianization of them purely for commercial reasons, to exploit the resources of the country? Is that what we're saying here?
Well, he was born in a British colony, the first British colony in Ireland.
Yeah.
So he knew firsthand what it was like to live under that sort of regime.
Yeah.
And he knew what it was like to be repressed. And these people saved his life, essentially.
Yeah.
With the beauty of Buddhism and cleaning out of his alcoholism, essentially.
Yeah.
So he felt a solidarity with the people and did not want to happen to them what he was born into. And, and that's what he took umbrage with.
I think. It's just that our knowledge and history of the missionaries are going there to improve the life of the people that they're going to proselytize to. Mm. Do you know what I mean? That's what that's what history tells us.
That's what history tells us. But history is written by the people who win.
Yeah.
Essentially, and that is why this man has been erased from history, essentially. He was only discovered back in 2009, so only in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And this year marks the 150th year of the anniversary of his birth.
Right.
So he would have been 150 years old this year.
Okay.
And he was essentially erased from history because of the exploits he had from the year 1900 to approximately 1911 was his sort of reign of terror, where he was standing up against the British, and I think he was kind of smart to aim his vitriol at the missionaries as opposed to the military.
Yeah,
it was kind of tactful in that regard, because he was tried for blasphemy, he was tried for sedition, he was imprisoned a few times. He was a real activist, a real anarchist in that regard. And I think if he was aiming his vitriol more at the military, he would have been silenced a lot quicker and probably paid the ultimate price with his life by standing in front of a firing squad. So I think he was quite tactful like that. And that suggests to me, and to the research of this project, that he must have, while in his time in the States, like there's 27 years of his life that are still a mystery. But we can only speculate that he, I think he got a lot of his organizational skills from his time in the States. I'm sure he was probably part of some Woody Guthrie style unions and things like that, where he was really standing up for the, you know, a Robin Hood kind of figure. Yeah, he's a working class hero, essentially.
Just moving on a little bit, Ian, what decided you to look at the life story and to try and have the film made, which we'll talk about in a little bit as well?
Well, I think that the what endeared me to the story, well, what struck me first initially was when I first read about this guy, and this was just browsing the internet, I came across an article on the BBC Religion and Ethics website that mentioned this Irish atheist, hobo, anti-colonial Irish monk, and my jaw dropped at the headline. And I started reading this it was just a short, probably 500 word article, and I was just like, why the hell am I learning about this guy now? Why isn't he part of our history books? Why wasn't I learning about him in school? Why isn't he, you know, a commonplace name like, you know, Daniel O'Connell or Michael Collins or Oscar Wilde or anyone else that's notable in Irish history for you know, being excellent at life, you know? And I was just like, why am I only finding out about this guy now? And the reason being is that the biggest injustice is that he was erased by a superpower from history. And that's why we're only discovering him now. And I'm not saying I'm discovering him, it's that my work is based upon the work of these three incredible college professors. There's Lawrence Cox, Dr. Lawrence Cox in Maynooth, and Dr. Brian Bocking in UCC, and Alicia Turner, who's in York University in Toronto. And like, my film is kind of a lot about their story as well, in managing to piece this life story together. Because you got to remember that this guy, Lawrence Carroll Damaloka, was traveling in a time without passports. And he was changing his name left, right, and center for all sorts of reasons. And so in order to sort of piece together his life, considering that, you know, a lot of what we know about him is it was lost in a couple of world wars and a lot of civil unrest in Burma, now Myanmar. That's commendable achievement to what they found. And they published their first findings in 2010 after discovering evidence of his existence in 2009.
So you came across him purely by accident, by just browsing the
purely by accident. Any kind of piece of inspiration to anyone who does anything creative is always an accident. It's never premeditated. It just came to me, and I just said, I have to make this film. I need to tell this man's story, because it's such an injustice that he's remained forgotten and really is only known in certain circles of academia.
Okay, well, Ian, I did say at the top of the interview that you're a filmmaker. So, well, tell us now about the film itself. I noticed it's part animated. It's a documentary, part animated, called The Dharma Bomb. Tell us a little bit, where is it in development at this point in time?
At this point in time, I'm running a crowdfunding campaign, which is kind of essential in this day and age for an independent film production. It kind of builds an audience and an interest into to a film that is in, you know, the early stages of production, whereas you can pre-order the film, and that helps in turn finance the film at the same time. I mean, I'm a former animator myself, and I'm still in love with the art form. And there's two reasons why I'm deciding to sort of reenact his life story through animation. And number one is that there's only one photograph of this man in existence. When he was ordained, he was taken to a photo studio, and a photograph was taken of him. A posed photograph was taken of him, and that's the only photographic evidence we have of him in existence. So there's no like archive footage we can pull up to sort of fill out the documentary. And I think it's kind of poetic that we're bringing this man back to life using what's considered to be a dying art form, which is 2D hand-drawn animation. And if you go to our website, thedharmabomb.eu, you'll see a little 1-minute trailer there where we have sort of reenacted that scene of him getting his photograph taken through animation, and that was quite a beautiful thing to do. I got goosebumps working with the animator, just watching this man be brought back to life through animation.
Can I just ask you a little bit about the animation, because I've kind of got an interest in it myself from past project that I was involved in. Has the animation been done here in Ireland?
I hope to get as much done in the country as possible.
Yeah.
It's not uncommon for certain aspects of the animation process, because it is lengthy and expensive, to be shipped out abroad. But it would be ideal to have the entire production done in house somewhere here in Ireland. I'm in talks with various studios in that capacity.
Right. Okay. With regard to the financing end of it now, how advanced is it at this point in time?
Well, the crowdfunding, like I said, works twofold, in that it kind of puts money in the bank in order to start developing the film and writing the scripts and things like that, and the character designs and all that kind of stuff, and creating the sort of the proof of concept of the animation, which we've showcased in the trailer. But of course, we're not adverse to more traditional sources of funding, such as the Irish Film Board and other kind of bodies like that. So we're in the process of moving into those avenues as well, because, you know, essentially animation is prohibitively expensive. It's an expensive thing, particularly when I want to sort of use a technique that is considered obsolete in these days, where, you know, sort of 3D animation and stuff that's done in computer is more sort of...
It's the norm now, isn't it, really?
Pardon me?
It's more like the norm these days, CGI
thing. It is
the
norm. So reanimating these are sort of old techniques it will be pricey. It will have a price on its head, but sort of I want to have the drawing style, and you'll see it in the trailer, is people's hands. It was handmade, essentially. And that's not to say anything derogatory towards the 3D animation technique. I've a lot of respect and love for that kind of style of filmmaking as well. It's just that in my heart, it's what I learned back in college, back when I first started, was I made animated movies and with pencil on paper, and I kind of miss that. That's dying, you know?
Yeah. Okay. Can you project when the public may get a glimpse of the film itself, the completed film, and hopefully it would be first shown in Dublin, obviously, when it is done?
Well, that would be the ultimate goal, yeah. And it would be fantastic to get it done this year, at the anniversary of its 150th birth.
Yeah.
That would be amazing.
Is that likely to happen?
Pardon me?
Is that likely to happen?
We're ready to roll. We're just waiting for word on funding. That's where we're at. We are barking at the gates, ready to roll. I mean, I've got a good crew together, a good selection of artists and people ready to roll. We're ready to roll. The only thing that's holding back right now is somebody signing a check, and that's what we're working on. And it's a difficult process. It's a lengthy process. I mean, I've been working on this for over a year now, and there's a good quote from Orson Welles that says that 99% of a filmmaker's life is trying to raise money, and 1% of actually making a film.
Yeah,
and that's a crazy way to live. And there's a lot of truth to that. Yeah. You know, people think like, oh, you put together a film and out it comes, but you got to remember that years prior to that film being made is people just meeting and making phone calls and trying to get the money men to
open their wallets, basically. Yeah. Okay, Ian, we're gonna have to leave it there.
Sure.
But it's a fascinating story, and there's so much more to it that we could have
gone into, but we just don't have the time.
I understand it. We're gonna have to come back to it at some stage, because we have to talk about his disappearance at some stage and never being found again, like wandering off into the forests in Boom or something like that. That's
He faked his own death as well, which is pretty funny.
Yeah. Okay. Listen, Ian, thanks very much for taking the call, and the best of luck. I really do hope that the project comes to fruition and we can all watch it on the big screens in the cinemas in Dublin. Hopefully this year.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah. Okay. I'll talk to you soon. Thanks a million, Ian.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yes, that was Ian Lawton talking to me about his part animated film, The Dharma Bum, about Lawrence Carroll. And the link to the film is www.thedharmabum.eu. And the crowdfunding page is www.dana, that's dana.io/thedharmabum. And it only costs €1 to pre-order the film.